Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. This week, we will hear a newer episode of Desert Oracle Radio from Ken Lane. The title is The Wild Beasts, and it was produced August 11th, 2023. Next up, Ken reminisces on some of his glory days with an episode he calls Death Valley Junction. He produced it August 25th, 2017. So remember that the events he mentions at the end are in the past. You have to time travel to get to them.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. When the summertime desert comes alive. Up here in the hills, once it's dark and the last of the noisy people go back inside. The narrowest of trails become busy with mule deer, especially. The mule deer herds move in mysterious ways. Sometimes it's the winter-summer migration. Sometimes it's to range around an area they call home for a whole season. Sometimes the mule deer will make huge journeys of 100 or 200 miles and then do the same thing a week or two later. Mule deer herds make these journeys with some regularity. Despite the barriers and threats of highways, fences, railroads, rivers, and streams, some will stay in one place for months, while others will wander 100 miles to a spot that looks just like the first, with an equal supply of food. And wherever they go, wherever they range on those narrow deer hoof highways, that you'll notice if you pay attention to the ground, to the spaces between juniper and Joshua tree. They're shadowed by the great predator of our land, the mountain lion. The lion, too, will travel hundreds of miles. Needs to travel hundreds of miles. Needs to master its vast territory. To hunt food. To find mates. But also to live, to thrive. Life is in movement, in change, in adventure. The mule deer know this. The cougar knows this. We know it too. Deep in our inborn knowledge of this majestic earth. This is Desert Oracle Radio. With soundscapes composed and performed by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. This radio program often regards the many mysteries of the desert. Strange lights in the night sky. Strange shadows around the campfire. Tales of ancient monsters. Like the Yucca Man. The Desert Sasquatch. Lost ships on the sand dunes. Arabian camels wandering the Colorado desert at Yuma. Here's a mystery I am somewhat of an expert on because it happened to me. It's a small mystery. Nobody's going to do a History Channel series about it. But I am the expert witness, I suppose. Happened last year, taking the long way home through the middle of Nevada, coming back from a work trip out in Utah. Was it Green River? I think so. With an overnight in Moab to do a radio show at the station there, KZMU, up on the hilltop. Thank you. I was enjoying one of my favorite drives, the winding two-lane of Utah's Highway 56 into Lincoln County, Nevada, where it becomes State Route 319, goes over the Cedar Range and through glorious high desert forest of pinyon and juniper and Joshua trees. I was thinking of heading up to the Mount Irish Wilderness again, where I'd gone a few years previous, hunting petroglyphs that look a lot like the things some people call space monsters today. But it was getting dark by then because Nevada is a big place and those roads eat up the daylight hours before you know it. Especially when you're always stopping to walk around, poke around, take some pictures, linger in the great silence for a spell. It looked like I might make it up Highway 93 to Rachel before the diner closed. So off I drove towards the Little Alien. Ale, as in beer. Sort of like beer. In, as in I-N-N, the motel behind the diner. I remember the specific day and the specific time specifically because I can just look at the calendar and see when I was working in Utah that week. And I even posted a picture on my secret Instagram from the Little Alien, with the occasion being that I'd finally found a bottle of Bob Dylan's fancy bourbon at a bar right there in Rachel. There wasn't much left of the bottle, so I got it all on the rocks, a perfect drink and a half to go with my iced tea and the cheeseburger plate. I don't know what they call the cheeseburger plate, the laser burger or something. The Bob Lazar burger. The implausible burger. Because when you're in Rachel, you are right up against the northeastern boundary of Area 51. There's even a monument outside the diner where the governor did a ribbon cutting for the establishment of the extraterrestrial highway back in the middle 1990s. This was a tourist promotion. And they had some actors from one of the Star Trek shows there and some people from the new Independence Day movie. Because there was a scene or two shot around there, although the Area 51 scenes were really filmed up by Wendover, another government military base with a long and dangerous history, chemical and biological weapons for one, and the airbase where the Enola Gay took off for its fateful and hideous mission to drop the bombs on Japan. There's an ugly spirit there, you can feel it. But I was down in Rachel, which has its own strange spirits. But on this night, it was just fine. It was beautiful, a weird diner on a lonesome desert highway, no tourists. I was the only tourist, the only customer on this weeknight. But about halfway through my dinner, another traveler arrived. She took a seat at the counter and we got to talking. Because we were both driving the desert roads alone for the adventure and the romance of it all. So we got to trading stories of where we'd come from, what we'd seen and done, etc. And it was one of those pleasant situations with a stranger that rarely occurs. But then it was time for me to hit the road. And she was car camping at the little Bailey Inn, which you can do if you want. So I walked out to my car, and before I left, I gave her a copy of Desert Oracle, and she gave me these stickers from inside her car that she said she'd made to raise money for some half-dead little kitten she'd rescued back home in Virginia, North Carolina. North Carolina, I believe it was, and we said goodbye, and as I was driving into the night, I was ever watchful of the dark, dark skies. And it was a lovely drive up State Route 375 to Warm Springs and then westward on US 6, the Grand Army of the Republic Highway, twirling the radio dial to see what scratchy signals might turn up. Ever alert for strange low lights zipping through that immense black sky or hovering over the dark landscape. My usual motel had a room for me in Tonopah, AAA discount and everything. But within a couple of days, I was back in Joshua Tree and doing the usual stuff back to the grind. A week or two later, I came across the cat stickers in some pocket or another, and I figured I'd write to her. Because how often do you meet somebody interesting in an empty E.T. conspiracy-themed Area 51 diner hours from civilization? Well, the Instagram account was right there on the stickers, on both of them. The cat had a funny name, too, easy to remember. Well, there was no such account. I searched a few variations. And something did come up, but it was not quite right. The cat's name was off. Though somewhat close. And the account had not been updated in a while. The location was more or less correct. But the cat looked entirely different than the picture of the cat on the sticker. And the person who took care of this cat looked different too. Not different haircut sort of thing, but clearly not the person I'd met and talked to for half an hour. Her name was different too. Similar but different. I remembered the name because I'd signed the book to her. I looked at these stickers again, two different designs, both the sort of stickers you could put on a car, the ones you pay to get made, like from Sticker Guy up in Reno. Both stickers had the same social media handle. But there was absolutely no evidence of that name, that social media handle, that Instagram name, anywhere on the internet. Nothing. What can you do? Beyond saying, well, this is one of those things that doesn't quite add up. Because who are we anyway? Who are we really? How many variations of each of us are out there somewhere living similar lives, doing similar things with similar names, and never the twain shall meet? Years ago, I ran into a guy I used to know while I was picking up some stuff at the Home Depot. This is before the Builder's Supply reopened in Yucca Valley. One of those mountain bike guys with the bicycles with the knobby tires and whatever. And they wear those helmets. So I sort of knew him, but without his helmet, I did not recognize him at first. He recognized me. He mentioned where I used to live, miles away from where I lived then or now, very out of the way place. That's where we'd cross paths, literally, a couple of times a week as I was out walking and he was out bicycling. I mentioned that I had not lived up there for years and he looked at me funny and said, "I see you there all the time, you and your dog." I said, well, that dog passed away a couple of years ago. And after waiting a while, I'd only just picked up another dog from the pound and had never been up there with this new dog. Huh, he said. And then he said that again. Huh. I should add here that I generally saw this guy when I had to step off a narrow trail so he could get by face to face. My doppelganger. Maybe it was my doppelganger. Not in the modern sense. Somebody who sort of looks like you, has the same computer bag or whatever, the same ball cap. But a psychic impression I'd left on that land, walking it every day for so many years. It was always the best part of my day, sometimes the only good part. I know every twist and turn and rock outcropping and stand of yucca trees for miles around there. I could walk it in the dark and often did in the hottest part of summertime. No moon necessary. I believe in the future. That's something I believe in. The world's not gonna end. Wild new times can come again. As they did for people before the horror, before the grind, stripped of everything. Like Bob Dylan said to a news agency reporter 30 years ago, people are lost because they can believe anything. But a person without faith is like a walking corpse. But now people have to fight to get the faith back. Faith in what, though? Real gods require no faith, they just are. Expressed in the life force of the pronghorn herd racing across the high desert. Expressed in the invigorating violence of a summer thunderstorm. The lightning strike of a rattler upon its prey, the geckos battling for the precious spot by the patio door where the occasional bugs get in. The pair of mourning doves bringing up each of their dozen offspring with the same determination and patience and love, one after another. expressed in the surprise and quick learning of a young rock squirrel trying to get a drink from the water bowl I keep outside for those same doves. The big metal bowl was near empty, so when the squirrel used its hands to lift itself up to the edge, the bowl tilted and most of the remaining water poured out, mostly onto the young squirrel. First, the squirrel drank what it could from the water on the patio, then, much more carefully now, it intentionally tilted the bowl down and drank deep and returned the bowl to its original position and looked around with satisfaction. The thirst was sated. The squirrel had mastered its environment through the power of will. The gods are expressed in other ways, in dreams and visions. Sometimes, if we are open to these higher energies, and sometimes as manifestations in the waking life, but only in wild nature or the edge of wilderness, where the farm meets the forest, the road meets the great wide open. And here they may appear in their classic forms as the great poets described in millennia past. The Lady of Light, the Horned Pan, the great monsters of the cave lair, the flying shields over battlefields of ancient times glowing with unquenchable fire. From Amboy to Zyzix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, you've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio with musical soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Look him up on Bandcamp. You can get all his records for like, I don't know what it is, $30 or something? It's like the price of a drive-through dinner. I'm your host, Ken Lane. Here at Desert Oracle, we love the Halloween time more than just about anything, from about mid-October here in the high desert and the piney mountains all around and right through Thanksgiving. That's what esoteric scholars call Halloween time. And this Halloween time, I will be bringing Desert Oracle Radio to a very moody place, the ruins of the old Hot Springs Bathhouse in Hakumba, on the edge of the desert, Saturday, October 20, Halloween time 20 and 23 at Hakumba Hot Springs, about an hour east of San Diego, 90 minutes west of Yuma, 3 hours south of Joshua Tree. All times by motor vehicle, but it would be fun to go on horseback, maybe down from Julian. Bring a couple of fresh apple pies down. Nothing better in the fall, apple pie for breakfast, a whole pot of coffee right there on the table. All on the picnic table outside. Good night from the voice of the desert.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California. Now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Now is the time because night has fallen on the American desert. When did you first see Death Valley? For me, it was the cold winter of 1982, one of those notorious El Nino winters, and I squeezed into a beat-up Volkswagen Beetle with three other high school hooligans. Somehow we'd all caught desert fever, not valley fever, the killer lung fungus common to Phoenix. but desert fever, a crazed longing for being far from the stains of human civilization, the bozo version we endure in California and what they used to call the Sun Belt, when there was some novelty in moving away from Ohio or Michigan and settling where the sun always shines and where there's no water. Well, we bounced up Interstate 15 through Barstow and had a 3 a.m. breakfast in Baker at the Bun Boy, plenty of coffee. And then north on Highway 127 as the sky lightened and the white winter sun suddenly topped Kingston Peak, and there it was. I'd never seen anything so vast in my life. Yes, I'd been to the Grand Canyon on a school field trip when I lived in Arizona, and that is certainly big, but it's big in the wrong direction. Down. Here, the valley ahead spread out for what must have been hundreds of miles. The road shrinking in the distance, going from wide blacktop ribbon to a thin, dark thread. The Funeral Mountains rising to the northwest, cold gray clouds clotted around the peaks. No sign of another human, no cops. Just the four of us in a primer and bondoed, falling apart VW bug with a broken heater fan, 30 degrees Fahrenheit outside and not much warmer inside. We parked sideways in the middle of the two-lane highway sometime after dawn. Got out to breathe that fresh, cold desert air. We cracked some beers to greet the day. Miller Genuine Draft, if memory serves, a premium brew. The color of urine after eating too many vitamin C's, no low-rent Schaefer cans for us. Whatever the 1980s looked like, pastels and hair gel mostly, this was the opposite. My 35mm camera, my father's actually, was loaded with black and white film, with Kodachrome color slide film as the backup roll. I stood in the road and took pictures of this ridiculous junker car, my juvenile delinquent friends using the roof as a beer table. It was magnificent. We were blue-collar romantics, you could say. High school was wrapping up. College was not on the schedule. We read books and we went to punk rock shows and watched weird movies from the special interest section of the local videotape and used record shop. Ronald Reagan was president and that gang was hoping to start the draft again because of El Salvador and the Sandinistas. Well, at least we had America's national parks to enjoy for the moment. We wandered through tunnels underneath the old Furnace Creek Inn. But we were not welcome in the restaurant due to our general appearance. Those were the days when wearing a pair of Levi's was enough to get you refused service at a sit-down restaurant. Well, we sneered at the middle-aged in their pink polo shirts and their pressed khaki slacks, and we moved on. But in truth, the whole national park was crowded with snowbirds and their RVs and packaged tourists pouring out of comfortable buses from Las Vegas. And after hitting the visitor center and its talking dioramas, I croaked out, "The boys have come, the boys have come," and making the required stops at Scotty's Castle and Badwater, well, we headed out, back to the place that looked so interesting on the drive-in, Death Valley Junction. It looked like a diorama itself, a whitewashed, dusty, Spanish-style plaza holding a rundown hotel with greasy windows and some abandoned rock and mineral shops and a meeting hall at the end. The Amargosa Opera House. The place had an eerie feel, that particular feeling that goes with being alone, but not quite alone. There were people in there, From the looks of a semi-functional pickup truck parked nearby and the occasional glance of a face turning away on the other side of those dirty windows. But nobody bothered us, so we walked around and we took a lot of pictures and tried various doorknobs, all of which were locked. It was the winter holiday season and the place was clearly not welcoming any visitors. The gas station and garage across the two-lane highway had not been operational in a long time. I was still walking around, going through the colonnades, when my friends said they were ready to go. Well, I was not sure I wanted to leave at all. 15 years prior, a dancer named Marta Beckett found herself in the same place to get a tire fixed at the filling station, still in operation at the time, in 1967. She and her husband had been visiting the National Monument, and while waiting for repairs at Death Valley Junction, she also fell under the spell of this strange, bright place. Marta Beckett decided to stay. It was 1967, after all, and free spirits from the cold and dreary Northeast were popping up all over the rural West, back to the land, away from the turmoil of the poison cities. She peeked into the old community hall and saw in her mind's eye a beautiful theater. She would dance here, she decided, performing her own show. Marta Beckett tracked down the owner of the abandoned Pacific Borax Company little town of Death Valley Junction and agreed right then and there to pay $45 a month rent for the whole place, which needed a lot of work. One issue she needed to address was the lack of townspeople, the lack of neighbors, the lack of an audience. And so she painted the audience over many years on the walls of the meeting hall that she renamed the Amargosa Opera House. These paintings, seen up close, are mildly terrifying. To be honest, I found Marta Beckett's whole deal to be mildly terrifying, what with her creepy clown ballet and the insane faces painted on every flat surface. That's why I liked it, the idea of it anyway. All those years of hanging around Death Valley Junction, and I never once tried to see her one-woman show. The idea of it was quite enough. Marta Beckett was about as weird as they come, and she found a place as creepy as her own imagination. There was this shaggy-haired alleged comedian named Tom who arrived after Marta's husband headed out for good, and Tom was nearly as weird, serving as Marta's shabby master of ceremonies. Now, despite doing a good business in tourist season and getting all kinds of mainstream media coverage from the likes of National Geographic and the network news magazine shows, the place was never maintained, never really repaired. The whole scene was a bit wrong, as would become apparent in later years when Marta Beckett's story went from a charming PBS tale of an eccentric artist to what was probably lingering around the place all along. Dark secrets. And in her old age, whispered claims of senior abuse that occasionally made the local newspapers, and sketchy characters wrangling over her value in monetary terms. It's a haunted place in a very real sense. Bad things have happened there, odd things. There are tales of babies buried in the walls, of drownings, of despair and manipulation and loneliness. That is the shadow world of Death Valley Junction, and each night it returns. And if you were there in the night, you will sense it, but it is also a place of inspiration, a place of hard beauty, a place where certain kinds of people could look around at the auto junkyard and the broken gas pumps and the peeling white plaster piled up around the buildings and say, "This is the place." Another artist of the time, a bum with a philosophy degree and a Mozart flute, was driving a school bus through Death Valley Junction twice a day when Marta Beckett decided to stay. Up at Ash Meadows, which was still a whorehouse at the time and had a nice little bar room, this philosopher waited out the school day under the swamp cooler, putting together his account to being a seasonal park ranger in Utah in the 1950s. This philosopher and school bus driver, who had published three novels to no particular acclaim, was Edward Abbey, and the book he was working on would be published in 1968 as Desert Solitaire. Edward Abbey died a generation ago, but Marta Beckett kept on ticking until January 30th of 2017, when she died at the extremely ripe old age of 92. She was still performing her show until 2012, and I never saw it. And I do not even want to see a YouTube video of the thing. It's perfect as it is. As for me and my hoodlum friends, we returned to Death Valley and the surrounding wilderness again and again. On our second trip, we found a light on at Death Valley Junction, and we convinced that shaggy character within to rent us a room or two for the night, as we had no camping equipment and it was very cold out. We bribed him with $20 and a couple of beers, and he pointed us down a dusty, decrepit hallway to a couple of connecting rooms, seemingly unchanged since construction was completed in the 1920s. The beds were small and dirty and uncomfortable. There were grotesque paintings leaning here and there, some by Marta and some left from the days of the borax mine. The rooms were unheated and the wind howled through the broken windows, and we downed enough beers to sleep but were awoken repeatedly by doors creaking open and dresser drawers inching outward and the sounds of footsteps and whispers in the hallway. In the 3 or 4 decades since, as a suspected mind ray from an ancient satellite continues to diminish the mental capacity of the average American, a popular form of televised entertainment involves hillbillies bumping around spooky old houses at night, pointing voltage meters at invisible ghosts and each other, and claiming dust balls on their cell phone photos are spirit orbs. According to the internet, many of these people have since brought their ghost meters and reality TV cameras to Death Valley Junction, and they claim the place is creepy as hell, and they're right. I've never really gotten the place out of my mind. It met an ideal I had not yet developed, a kind of mental painting of a very striking building or small compound all by itself at a high desert crossroads. A place out of a dream. Late summer is a bittersweet time in the Mojave Desert. While we all look forward to the cooler temperatures and the promise of being able to go outside during the day without crying, we do not always look forward to the return of the tourist. But, being good Americans, we will take the money, as it is still required, to make some sort of wage, one way or another. Sometimes you'll notice certain kinds of wild plants start showing up somewhere you've been hanging around for years and years. I don't recall ever seeing so much damned borage in the high desert. Or maybe it's seeing so many burrs produced by the borage. Maybe that's the part that seems new, because this was the first sort of wet year after a long, long drought. I did some research, and sure enough, borage is becoming more common in the Mojave Desert. So say those who keep records of such things. Here's something interesting. If you pronounce borage as burr sage, that's just what it looks like. A little sagebrush growing terrible yellow burrs. And while borage looks a little better, it is related to the hated roadside ragweed that provides so much discomfort in the form of allergies and ugliness across the desert Southwest. Ragweed. Wherever you see it, you know somebody just doesn't care enough to cut it down. And that way, it's what biologists call a indicator species. It indicates a bad place where residents or road crews just don't bother. Many years back, I noticed a man in a big floppy sun hat walking very, very slowly down my dirt road on hot mornings. And then I saw him walking even more slowly along a couple of acres I had up there, and I went out to say hello and make sure he wasn't a serial killer or escaped from a secure facility for lunatics, and he looked up from underneath that big hat with a neighborly grin. And I said, "Hello, Mr. Mayor." For the mystery man was my own neighbor at the time, then the mayor of Yucca Valley. I learned it was his habit to go out in the spring and the summer and pull ragweed from the sides of the road, regardless if it was along his property or a neighbor's. Until that moment, I had never appreciated that the lack of ragweed on our road was not an accident of nature. And while I live somewhere else entirely now, I have adopted his habit because it makes a tremendous difference in how you feel about a place when you don't have to drive or walk through a hideous forest of waist-high, sick-smelling ragweed just to get home and back. Let's just take a walk up here. I want to make sure nothing was left behind. I came through here yesterday and came upon a video production again. Day 3. With some pop band mimicking the playing of a song. They had a bunch of mirrored panels set up behind the drum kit up there against those boulders, an approximation of that art installation down in Palm Springs. Now, this being a nature preserve, you might think having 15 trucks and a bunch of 10-foot-tall mirrored panels and camera dollies would be inappropriate, especially hours after sunset when the preserve is closed to human traffic. Well, it sadly occurred to me that even if this film crew had all the required permits in a crooked place like this, the permit fee was probably requested in the form of cash or a personal check. And the Mojave, of course, is mostly federal land, national parks, national monuments. Open space, nature preserves, wildlife sanctuaries, wildlife corridors, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine bases. Well, it's a place of great importance, ecologically, militarily, financially, of course. Always in the news for one reason or another. Whether in the travel section or regarding whatever amateur mafia characters in Washington are currently trying to steal it all away from the people and give it to their brother-in-law's mining company, etc. But if you want to screw up a day-use-only conservation area with your dumb music video shoot for 3 or 4 days and nights, they will take your money hours away from here. In some dark, grimy office in the smoggy hellscape of San Bernardino. Now, not half a mile from this musical video setup, I came across a passenger car parked haphazardly on the dirt road here. And a grown woman standing outside of it with a hula hoop bouncing around her hips. It's almost like people don't know what to do with themselves.
Thank you.
Probably the first classical music album I ever owned was Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony, Symphony No. 9 in E minor from the New World. I tell you, I mostly bought the record because it had a picture of the Grand Canyon on the cover. It said New World Symphony, and there was the Grand Canyon, so I assumed it had something strongly to do with the desert Southwest. And if you've ever taken a walk in the desert, listening to the New World Symphony on your earbuds, you know that everything seems more exciting and adventurous. Every frightened quail, every jackrabbit bounding by, every strange sound, all infused with drama. Well, it turns out that Dvořák did not write the New World Symphony in the desert Southwest at all. He never went to the Grand Canyon. In fact, the wide open spaces that apparently inspired this American symphony were the prairies of Iowa. Dvořák wrote Symphony No. 9 in E minor in a New York hotel room. It's when he was the director of the National Conservatory of Music of America. This was in the late 1800s. He wrote the symphony in 1893. But it was very much inspired by the music of America, specifically the music of Native Americans and African American spirituals. It has become one of the most popular symphonies of all time, and it was even played on the moon by Neil Armstrong during the first moon landing, the first human moon landing, in 1969. And in 1964, August, astronauts Frank Borman, Neil Armstrong, John Young, and Deke Slayton underwent survival training at Stead Air Force Base, 10 miles north of downtown Reno. NASA astronauts trained for a bewildering array of disasters in the 1960s, including the possibility of a crash landing on desert terrain. Should an Apollo capsule fail to splash down in the ocean as planned, the crew would be prepared for any kind of remote environment on Earth. As deserts make up one-third of our planet's landmass, knowing how to survive a desert crash landing could be the difference between life and death. Some announcements. We are presenting Desert Oracle Campfire Stories in person at the Ace Hotel and Swim Club in Palm Springs on the first Thursday of the month, 7 p.m. outside around the campfire, but also next to a cocktail bar and a swimming pool, September 7th, and continuing on the first Thursdays in October, November, December, free and open all. Hope to see you there in the fine months of fall. This program is brought to you by Desert Oracle, the pocket-sized quarterly journal of the American desert. Become a subscriber today and you'll receive four delightful issues filled with interesting stories about our arid lands. Send $25 by check or money order to Desert Oracle, P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California, or subscribe online at desertoracle.com. our autumn issue will be here in September, such is my pledge to you. Meanwhile, you can pick up the summer issue. That's issue number 6. Last week I misspoke and called it summer issue number 7, I assume, because I dearly wish number 7 was already done and sent to the printers. Anyway, you can pick up the current issue at Red Rock Books in Ridgecrest. At the Little Alien next to Area 51, right there in Rachel, Nevada. At the beloved Cactus Mart in Morongo Valley, and of course at Back of Beyond Books in Moab, Utah, just down the highway from Arches National Park. Speaking of Arches and Back of Beyond Books, we are teaming up with that fine independent bookstore for next year's 50th anniversary of the publication of Desert Solitaire. It was half a century ago when Edward Abbey's great book was first published, a book that defines desert conservation beautifully and wildly written, a book that for so many of us sealed the deal. Desert Oracle will publish a special edition, autumn 2018, next year, that's all about Abbey's famed and influential Desert Solitaire. Oh, and get this, we're going to have some previously unpublished little gems from Mr. Abbey himself, at least that's the plan. Thanks for listening to the program on KCDZ 107.7 FM Fridays. You never know when, but they strive for 10. Heard from Ann Boyd as Isaacs and across the great Mojave Wilderness. Write to us. It's radio@desertoracle.com. And good night from the voice of the desert.
So I wonder if our own mule deer and mountain lion travel as far as the desert variety. Maybe I can find a biologist who knows. Till then, let's bookmark that subject. And I also wonder if we have any little places in Montana with stories like Death Valley Junction. I bet we do. And I'll be following up on this subject too on a future episode. Do you have any expertise in wildlife, or do you have a unique experience to share? Well, as always, you can call me and leave a message about anything on your mind, including wildlife or a unique story. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. Well, that's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. I think we're going to have you two take us out today.